Osho, The Book of Wisdom, Volume 1. Discourses on Atisha's 7 Points of Mind Training. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 4.
The first question. Bhagwan. Some time ago, while asleep in the night, I dreamed I was at a lecture. In the morning, I could not remember anything you had said, except the phrase, "Poetry is surrender." Since then, I have been wondering what poetry has to do with surrender and vice versa, and how poetry can be a path like love, prayer, and meditation. Devaricha, poetry contains all. It contains love, it contains prayer, it contains meditation, and much more. All that is divine, all that is beautiful, all that can take you to the transcendental is contained in poetry. Poetry is not just poetry. Poetry is essential religion. Poetry means a state of being where mind is no more interfering between you and existence. When there is communion between you and existence, direct, immediate, when you are suddenly possessed by the whole, where you disappear as a separate entity, and the whole starts speaking through you, it starts dancing through you, where you become a hollow bamboo and the whole transforms you into a flute. Poetry is the whole descending into the part, the ocean disappearing into the dewdrop. Poetry is a miracle, and when I use the word poetry, my fingers are not pointing to Shakespeare's Kalidasas. They are only partial poets. Yes, they had known certain moments of poetry, but they are not poets. They had few glimpses when the doors of the unknown were open to them. They had some access to the deepest sources of life. But those moments were seer gifts from the unknown. They knew nothing how to reach them. They knew nothing how the whole reaches to them. It was almost a state of unconsciousness. It had happened in a dream, just it has happened to you in a dream. They were dreamers. All the so-called great poets of the world, great painters, musicians, sculptors, they were all dreamers. Yes, they had few glimpses in their dreams. Something infiltrated, a ray of light here and there, was able to pass through the dream barrier. And even that single ray was enough to create a Shakespeare or a Kalidas. But that's not what I'm pointing at. When I say poetry, I mean that which has flown through the Buddhas. That is true poetry. Buddha is not a dreamer. Atisa is not a dreamer. If they are anything, they are awakened people. Dreams have disappeared, evaporated. Now it is not only a glimpse of truth that comes to them, unawares, possesses them, and then leaves them empty, spent, exhausted. The ordinary poet simply hops for a moment. He is off ground, but only for a moment. Then again he is back on the ground. A Buddha has wings. He does not hop. He knows how to go to the farthest star. He knows the way to approach the unknown. He has the key to unlock the doors of the mysterious. He is a master. And then something starts flowing through him, which is not of his own. He is only a medium. He is possessed. Then whatsoever he says is poetry. Or, even if he keeps silence, his silence is poetry. His silence has tremendous music in it. Whether he speaks or does not, doesn't matter. Speaking, he speaks poetry. Not speaking, he remains poetry. He is surrounded by poetry. He walks in poetry. He sleeps in poetry. Poetry is his very soul. It is his essential being. How this poetry happens? It happens in surrender. It happens when the part gathers courage enough to surrender to the whole. When the dew drops, it slips into the ocean and becomes the ocean. Surrender is a very paradoxical state. On the one hand, you disappear. On another hand, you appear for the first time in your infinite glory, in your multidimensional splendor. Yes, the dewdrop is gone, and gone forever. There is no way to recapitulate it, reclaim it. The dewdrop has died as a drop. But in fact, the dewdrop has become the ocean, has become oceanic. He exists still, but no more as a finite entity, but as something infinite, soreless, boundless. This is the meaning of the myth of the bird Phoenix. He dies. He is utterly burnt, reduced to ashes, and then suddenly he is reborn out of the ashes. Resurrection. The Phoenix represents Christ, crucifixion and resurrection. The Phoenix represents Buddha, death as an ego and a new birth as utterly egolessness. It represents all those who have known. To know means to be a phoenix. Die as you are, so that you can be that which you really are. Die in all your inauthenticity, phoniness, separation from existence. We go on believing that we are separate. We are not. Not even for a single moment. In spite of your belief, you are one with the whole. But your belief can create nightmares for you. It is bound to create. To believe that I am separate means to create fear. If you are separate from the whole, you can never get rid of fear, because the whole is so vast and you are so small, so tiny, so atomic, and you have constantly to fight the whole so that it does not absorb you. You have to be constantly alert, on guard. So the ocean simply does not take you in. You have to protect yourself behind walls and walls and walls. All this effort is nothing but fear. And then constantly you are aware that death is reaching, and the death is going to destroy our separation. That's what death is all about. Death is the whole claiming the part back. And you are afraid that death will come and you will die. How to live long? How to attain a kind of deathlessness? Man tries it in many ways. To have children is one of the ways. Hence, the continuous urge to have children. The root of this desire to have children has nothing to do with children at all. It has something to do with death. You know you will not be able to be here forever. Howsoever you try, you are going to fail. You know it, because millions have failed and nobody has ever succeeded. You are hoping against hope. then find out some other ways. One of the simplest, the most ancient way is to have children. You will not be here, but something of you, a particle of you, a cell of you will go on living. That is a vicarious way of becoming immortal. Now science is finding far more sophisticated ways. Because your child may look a little bit like you, may not look at all. And it will be only just a little bit like you. There is no intrinsic necessity for him to appear exactly like you. So now science has found ways how to duplicate. Some of your cells can be preserved. And when you die, out of those cells, a duplicate can be created. And the duplicate will be exactly like you. Not even twins are so alike. If you meet your duplicate, you will be surprised. It will be exactly like you. Absolutely like you. Now they say, to be safer, a duplicate can be created while you are alive. And the duplicate can be kept in deep freeze. So if some accident happens, you die in a car accident, you can be immediately replaced. Your wife will never be able to detect. Your children will never come to know that this daddy is just an imitation. Because he will be exactly like you. Men have tried in other ways also, far more sophisticated than this one. Write books, paint pictures, compose great symphonies. You will be gone, but the music will remain. You will be gone, but your signature will be there on the book. You will be gone, but the sculpture that you had created will be there. It will remind you. It will remind people of you. You will persist in their memories. You will not be able to walk on the earth, but you will be able to walk in people's memories. It is better than nothing. Become famous. Leave some marks in the history books. Of course, there will be only footnotes. But still, something is better than nothing. Man has been trying down the ages somehow to have some kind of immortality. Fear of death is so much. It haunts you your whole life. The moment you drop the idea of separation, the fear of death disappears. Hence I call this state of surrender the most paradoxical. You die on your own accord. And then you cannot die at all. because the whole never dies. Only the parts are being replaced. But if you become one with the whole, you will live forever. You will go beyond birth and death. That's the search for nirvana, enlightenment, moksha, the kingdom of God, the state of deathlessness. But the condition that has to be fulfilled is very frightening. The condition is, first you have to die as a separate entity. That's what surrender is all about. Dying as a separate entity, dying as an ego. And in fact, it is nothing to be worried about, because you are not separate. It is only a belief. So only the belief dies, not you. It is only a notion, an idea. It is like you have seen a rope in the darkness of the night, and you have got the notion that it is a snake, and you are escaping from the snake in tremendous fear, trembling, perspiring, and then somebody comes across and says, "Don't be worried, I know perfectly well, I have seen it in daylight, it is only a rope, and if you don't trust me, ehi passiko, come with me, I will show you it is only a rope." And that's what the Buddhas have been doing down the ages. Ehi passiko, come with me, come and see. And they take the rope by their hands and they show it to you that this is only a rope. The snake was never there in the first place. All fear disappears. You start laughing. You start laughing at yourself. That how foolish you have been. You have been escaping from something which never existed in the first place. But whether it existed or not, those drops of perspiration were real. The fear, the trembling, the heartbeat going faster, the blood pressure, all those things were real. Unreal things can trigger real things, remember it. If you think they are real, they function for you as reality. Only for you, it is a dream reality. But it can affect your whole life style. Ego is not there. The moment you become a little alert, aware, conscious, you will not find the ego at all. It will be a rope that you had misconceived as a snake. You will not find the snake anywhere. Death does not exist. Death is unreal, but you create it. You create it by creating separation. Surrender means dropping the idea of separation. Death disappears automatically. Fear is found no more. And your whole flavor of life changes. Then each moment is such a crystal purity, a purity of delight, joy, bliss. Then each moment is eternity. And to live that way is poetry. To live moment to moment without the ego is poetry. To live without the ego is grace, is music. To live without the ego is to live, really live. That life I call poetry. The life of one who is surrendered to existence. And remember, let me repeat it again. When you surrender to existence, you are not surrendering anything real. You are simply surrendering a false notion. You are simply surrendering an illusion. You are surrendering Maya. You are surrendering something that you had never with you in the first place. And by surrendering that which you don't have, you attain to that which you have. And to know that I am at home, to know that I have always been and I will always be, is a great moment of relaxation. To know that I am not an outsider, that I am not alienated, that I am not uprooted, that I belong to existence and that the existence belongs to me. All becomes calm and quiet and still. This stillness is surrender. The word surrender gives you a very, very wrong idea, as if you are surrendering something. You are not surrendering anything. You are simply dropping a dream. You are simply dropping something arbitrary that the society had created. The ego is needed. It has certain functions to fulfill in the society. Even when one is surrendered to God, one goes on using the word I. But now it is only something utilitarian, nothing existential. He knows he is not. He uses the word because not using it will be unnecessarily creating trouble for others. It will make communication impossible. It is already impossible. It will be more difficult to communicate with people. So it is just an arbitrary device. If you know it is a device, arbitrary, utilitarian, useful, but nothing existential, it never creates any problem for you. Richa, your dream has given you a glimpse. Your dream has allowed you something. Something you may not be allowing while you are awake. It sometimes happens. The conscious mind is more egoistic. Obviously, the ego never penetrates into the unconscious. The society can only teach the conscious. The society cannot teach the unconscious. At least not yet. They are trying hard. In Soviet Russia particularly, they are trying hard to teach the unconscious. And unfortunately, they are succeeding. They are teaching people while they are asleep. When you are asleep, your conscious is no more functioning. Your unconscious functions. Now, in Russia particularly, they are making great experiments how to teach people while they are asleep, how to condition their minds while they are asleep. It can be done. It is being done. This is one of the great dangers that the future generations will have to face. If the politicians has gadgets with them which can teach people while they are asleep, then there will be no possibility of any rebellion ever. You can make a person while he is asleep a communist, Catholic, Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, Mohammedan. And because it will be in his unconscious, he will be absolutely unable to go beyond it. He will not be capable to get rid of it. Because the unconscious is 9 times more powerful than the conscious. The conscious is only the tip of the iceberg. 1/10 of your mind is conscious. 9/10 is unconscious. If the politician can reach to the unconscious, then humanity is doomed. Then children will be taught while they are asleep. Even the sleep will not be yours own and private. Even sleep will not be a personal thing. It will be owned by the state. You will not be even allowed to dream private dreams. The state will manage what dreams to dream. Because you may be dreaming some anti-state dreams. And the state cannot afford them. Your dreams can be manipulated. Your unconscious can be manipulated. But fortunately, it has not happened yet. You may be the last generation who has the possibility to rebel. And if you don't rebel, there may be no more chances. Humanity can be reduced into a robot-like existence. So rebel while the time is still there. I don't think there is much time left. Maybe just this last part of the century. These coming 20-25 years, if humanity can rebel in these 25 years, this is the last opportunity. Otherwise, people will be utterly unable. Their unconscious will dominate them. Up to now, society has been able only to pollute your conscious mind through education, through church, through propaganda, but only your conscious mind. Your unconscious is still free. It happens more often that you are closer to the truth, closer to reality, when you are deep asleep. It is very strange.
It should not be so. You should be closer to reality while you are awake. But your wakefulness is no more yours. It is Hindu, it is Christian, it is Mohammedan. It is no more yours. Society has already impinged upon it, interfered with it, distorted it. But the unconscious is still yours. Hence, psychoanalysis became so much interested in your dreams. Because in your dreams you are truer. In your dreams you are less false. In your dreams all the senses of the society disappears. In your dreams you are saying things as they are, seeing things as they are, seeing yourself as you are. The moment you awake, you start pretending. Your wakefulness is a long, long pretension. Hence, sleep is so much relaxing. Because continuously to be on guard and to say things which are supposed to be said and to do things which the society requires to be done is tiring. Very tiring. One needs to fall into deep sleep every day for 8 hours to get rid of all this, to be natural again, to forget the society and the nightmare and the hell that it has created. The more alert you become, the more watchful you are, the more freer from the bondage of the society and its clutches, then only your body will need sleep. And even in your sleep, there will continue an undercurrent of awareness. Your mind will not need any sleep. There is no intrinsic necessity for it to go into sleep. It is a created necessity. When your mind is clear, untethered, free, you will have less and less need for the mind to go to sleep. And then a miracle happens. If you can remain alert even while the body is asleep, you will know for the first time you are separate from the body. The body is asleep and you are awake. How can you both be identical? How you both can be one? You will see the difference. The difference is so vast. The body belongs to the earth, you belong to the sky. The body belongs to matter, you belong to God. The body is grass, you are not. The body has limits, is born and will die. You are never born and you will never die. This becomes your own experience, not a belief. The belief is fear-oriented. You would like to believe that you are immortal, but belief is just a belief, something pseudo, painted from the outside. Experience is totally different. It wells up within you. It is yours own. And the moment you know, nothing can ever shake your knowing. can destroy our knowing. The whole world may be against it. Still you will know that you are separate. The whole world will say there is no soul, but you will know there is. The whole world may say there is no God, you will smile. Because the experience is self-validating. It is self-evident. Richa, your dream may be very significant. What you have not allowed in your waking consciousness has sprung up in your dreaming consciousness. A ray of light has entered in you. In the West, before Freud, waking consciousness was thought to be the only consciousness. Not so in the East. Even after Freud, although dreaming consciousness is accepted as valuable, still one thing has not yet happened. Dreamless sleep is yet ignored. Not so in the East. The East has always accepted waking consciousness as the most superficial. Dreaming consciousness far more deeper and far more significant, and sleeping consciousness even more deeper, even more significant than dreaming consciousness. The West needs yet another Freud. To introduce sleep as the most significant part. But the East knows something more still. There is a point, the fourth state of consciousness. It is called Turiya. Simply the fourth. It has no other name. Turiya means the fourth. When waking, dreaming and sleep all disappear, one is simply a witness. You cannot call it waking, because this witness never sleeps. You cannot call it dreaming, because for this witness no dream ever appears. You cannot call it sleep, because this witness never sleeps. It is eternal awareness. This is Bodhicitta of Atisa. This is Christ consciousness. This is Buddhahood, enlightenment. So always be careful. Be more careful of your dreams than your waking. Again, be more careful of your dreamless sleep than of dreaming. And remember that you have to search the fourth, because only the fourth is the ultimate. With the fourth, you have arrived home. Now there is nowhere to go. Richa, you say you have forgotten all about the dream, but only remembered one phrase, poetry is surrender. That is the very essence of my teaching. The most fundamental thing about my message to the world is poetry is surrender, and vice versa, surrender is poetry. I would like my sannyasins, all of my sannyasins, to be creative. Poets, musicians, painters, sculptors, and so on and so forth. In the past, the sannyasins of all the religions have lived a very uncreative life. They were respected for their uncreativity. And because of this uncreativity, they have not added any beauty to the world. They have been a burden. They have not brought something of the paradise on the earth. In fact, they have been destructive. Because you can either be creative or you are bound to be destructive. You cannot remain neutral. Either you have to affirm life with all its joys, or you start condemning life. The past has been a long, long drawn nightmare of destructive attitudes, life negative approaches. I teach you life affirmation. I teach you reverence for life. I teach you not renunciation but rejoicing. Become poets. And when I say become poets, I don't mean that you all have to become Shakespeare's, Milton's and Tennyson's. If I come across Shakespeare and Milton and Tennyson, I will say them too. Please become poets. Because they are only dreaming about poetry. The real poetry happens in the fourth state of consciousness. All the great so-called poets have been only dreamers. They were confined to the second state of consciousness. The prose remains confined to the first waking consciousness, and your poetry goes to the second. The poetry I am talking about is possible only in the fourth, when you have become fully alert, clear, when there is no mind anymore. Then whatsoever you do will be poetry. Whatsoever you will do will be music. And even if you don't do a thing, the poetry will surround you. It will be your fragrance. It will be your very presence. Richa, you asked me, since then I have been wondering what poetry has to do with surrender and vice versa, and how poetry can be a path like love, prayer and meditation. Love is a path, prayer is a path, meditation is a path, because they are ways to poetry. Anything that leads you to God is bound to lead you to poetry. The man of God can nothing be but a poet. He will sing a song, not his own anymore. Of course, he will sing God's song. He will give utterance to the silence of God. He will be a mouthpiece to the whole. I teach you meditation, prayer, love, only because they all take you to the center, and the center is poetry. They are all ways to poetry. To dissolve yourself into poetry is to dissolve yourself into God. And certainly without surrender, it is not possible. If you remain too much, God cannot happen. You have to be absent for Him to become a presence in you. Die so that you can be. The second question, Bhagwan, utter confusion is my part. Good and bad have ceased to exist. I am neither proud nor ashamed, and yet I am both. Whatever I have achieved seems lost in a fog, resolved together with my failures. Like smoke I feel, but through the smoke a tremendous sadness arises, like a sharp rock with a velvet covering. Bhagwan, I can't perceive the end of it. Or is there no end? Is it ecstasy carrying the weight of impurity? Please, Bhagwan, give me sannyas. Ronald Salome's son, confusion is a great opportunity. The problem with people who are not confused is great. They think they know, and they know not. The people who believe that they have clarity are really in great trouble. Their clarity is very superficial. In fact, they know nothing of clarity. What they call clarity is just stupidity. Idiots are very, very clear. Clear in the sense that they have no intelligence to feel confusion. To feel confusion needs great intelligence. Only the intelligent ones feel confusion. Otherwise, the mediocres go on moving in life, smiling, laughing, accumulating money, struggling for more power, fame. If you see them, you will feel a little jealous. They look so confident. They look even happy. If they are succeeding, if their money is increasing, and their power is increasing, and their fame is growing, you will feel a little jealous. You are so confused, and they are so clear about their life. They have a direction, they have a goal, they know how to attain it, and they are managing. They are already achieving. They are climbing the ladder. And you are just standing there confused, what to do, what not to do, what is right, what is wrong. But this has always been so. The mediocre remains certain. It is only for the more intelligent to feel confusion, chaos. Confusion is a great opportunity. It simply says that through the mind there is no way. If you are really confused, as you say, I am utterly confused. If you are really confused, you are blessed. Now, something is possible, something immensely valuable. You are on the verge. If you are utterly confused, that means mind has failed. Now mind can no more supply any certainty to you. You are coming closer and closer to the death of the mind. And that is the greatest thing that can happen to any man in life. The greatest blessing. Because once you see that the mind is confusion and there is no way out through the mind, how long you can go on clinging with the mind? Sooner or later you will have to drop it. Even if you don't drop it, it will drop on its own accord. Confusion will become so much, so heavy, that out of sheer heaviness it will drop. And when the mind drops, confusion disappears. I cannot say that you attain to certainty. No, because that too is a word applicable only to the mind and the world of the mind. When there is confusion, there can be certainty. When confusion disappears, certainty also disappears. You simply are clear, neither confused nor certain. Just a clarity, a transparency. And that transparency has beauty. That transparency is grace. It is exquisite. It is the most beautiful moment in one's life when there is neither confusion nor certainty. One simply is a mirror reflecting that which is, with no direction to go anywhere, with no idea of doing something, with no future. Just utterly in the moment, tremendously in the moment. When there is no mind, there can be no future. There can be no program for the future. Then this moment is all, all in all. This moment is your whole existence. The whole existence starts converging on this moment, and the moment becomes tremendously significant. It has depth, it has height, it has mystery, it has intensity, it has fire, it has immediacy. It grips you, it possesses you, it transforms you. But I cannot give you certainty. Certainty is given by ideology. Certainty is nothing but patching up your confusion. You are confused. Somebody says, don't be worried. And says it very authoritatively. Convinces you with arguments, with scriptures, and patches up your confusion, covers it up with a beautiful blanket, with the Bible, with the Quran, with the Gita. And you feel good, but it is temporary, because the confusion is boiling within. You have not got rid of it. It has only been repressed. That's why people cling to beliefs, churches, scriptures, doctrines, systems of thought. Why people invest so much in systems of thought? Why somebody should be a Christian or a Hindu? Why somebody should be a communist? For what? There is a reason. A great reason too. Everybody is confused. And then somebody is needed to supply you certainty. He can be the Pope, or he can be Mao Zedong, he can be Karl Marx, or he can be Manu or Moses. Anybody will do. And whenever there are great times of crisis, any stupid person who has the stubbornness of shouting, of arguing, who can pretend certainty, will become your leader. That's how Adolf Hitler's, Joseph Stalin's, Mussolini's become important people. People have always been wondering why Adolf Hitler could dominate a great intelligent race like the Germans. Why? It appears like a paradox that men like Martin Heidegger, one of the greatest thinkers of this age, was a supporter of Adolf Hitler. The great professors of the great German universities supported Adolf Hitler. Why? How it was possible? And Adolf Hitler is just a stupid person. Uneducated, unsophisticated, but he has something in him that the professors were lacking, that the intelligent people were lacking, that Martin Heidegger's were lacking. He has something in him which no intelligent person can have. He has absolute certainty. He is idiotic, but he can say things with no ifs and no buts. He can make statements as if he knows. He is a madman. But his madness had great impact. It changed the whole course of human history. It is not a surprise why the Germans became so much interested and impressed by him. They were intelligent people. One of the most intelligent people on the earth. And intelligence always brings confusion. That is the secret of Adolf Hitler's success. Intelligence brings confusion. And confusion brings trembling, fears, one knows not where to go, what to do, and one starts looking for a leader. One starts searching for somebody who can say things with such absoluteness, who can assert categorically. The same has happened in India. Just now it has happened. This is one of the most ancient countries of the world. Longest tradition of thinking, contemplation. Longest tradition of philosophizing. No other country has philosophized so much, and then this country chooses a man like Morarji Desai as the Prime Minister. A cabbage. But he has something in him. The stubbornness of a mediocre mind. Absoluteness of stupidity. He has something important to supply. Whenever people are in confusion, they fall prey to third-rate minds. The first-rate minds fall prey to third-rate minds. Because the third-rate mind has no confusion. The third-rate mind knows that just by drinking your own urine, all diseases can be cured. Even cancer is curable by drinking your own urine. This is possible to assert only if you really are utterly unintelligent. The intelligent person hesitates, ponders, wavers. The unintelligent never wavers, never hesitates. Where the wise will whisper, the fool simply declares from the housetops. Lao Tzu says, I may be the only muddled-headed man in the world. Everybody seems to be so certain, except me. He is right. He has such tremendous intelligence that he cannot be certain about anything. I cannot promise you certainty if you drop the mind. I can promise you only one thing, that you will be clear. There will be clarity, transparency. You will be able to see things as they are. You will be neither confused nor certain. Certainty and confusion are two sides of the same coin. But you are in a beautiful moment. And the world too is in a beautiful moment. Whenever there is a crisis of identity, whenever people don't know who they are, whenever the past loses its grips, whenever people are uprooted from the traditional, whenever the past no more seems relevant, this crisis arises, a great crisis of identity, who we are, what we are supposed to do. This opportunity can turn into a curse too if you fall victim to some Adolf Hitler. But this curse can become a great opening into the unknown if you are fortunate enough to be in the vicinity of a Buddha. If you are fortunate enough to be in love with a Buddha, your life can be transformed. People who are still rooted in tradition and think they know what is right and what is wrong will never come to a Buddha. They will
continue to live their life, the routine life, the dull, the dead life. They will go on fulfilling their duties as their forefathers used to do. For centuries they have been following a track, and they will go on following the trodden track. Of course, when you follow a trodden track, you feel certain so many people have walked on it. But when you come to a Buddha and you start moving into the unknown, there is no highway, not a trodden path. You will have to make your own path by walking. The path will not be found ready-made. That's what I want my every sannyasin to understand. You are not here to depend on me. You are not here to follow me. You are not here to simply accept me and believe in me. You are here to experiment. You have to move on your own. I can give you encouragement to move on your own. I can trigger a process of inquiry into you, but I will not give you a system of thoughts. I will not give you any certainty. I will give you only a pilgrimage which is hazardous, a pilgrimage which has millions and millions of pitfalls, a pilgrimage in which you will have to face more and more dangers every day, a pilgrimage that will take you to the top of human consciousness, to the fourth state. But the higher you go, more is the danger of falling. I can promise you only a great adventure, risky, dangerous, with no promise that you will attain it. Because the unknown cannot be guaranteed. So, Ronald, if you have come to find some remedy for your confusion to me, you have come to me a wrong person. Then I am not the right person to be with. But if you have come to drop confusion and certainty and be free of the mind that can either give you confusion or certainty, if you have come to me to go on the ultimate adventure in search of God, if you have come to me to dare to accept the challenge of the uncharted sea, the roaring waves, and no possibility of seeing the other shore, then you have come to the right person. Then much is possible. I say only possible. I cannot say it is absolutely certain. It is always a possibility. You may be able to make it, you may not be able to make it. No guarantee. It is not a commodity which can be guaranteed. It is a gamble. And if you are ready to gamble, enter into this Buddha field. No need to wait any longer. You have waited already enough for many, many lives. You ask me, please, Bhagwan, give me sannyas. It is not a question of my giving you sannyas. It is a question of you taking it. open your heart. I am always giving it. The question is of your receiving it, welcoming it. You say good and bad have ceased to exist. That is good. That's beautiful. Good and bad are all man-made. Sinners and saints are all man-made. And they are not different at all. The difference is only superficial, very superficial, not even skin deep. Scratch a little and you will find in your saint the sinner. This guy went to the Pope and said, "Hey Pope, fuck you." The Pope could not believe it. He said, "Me?" The head of the Catholic Church? Me? The spiritual head of millions and millions? Me? The direct descendant of Jesus Christ? Me, the only representative of God on earth? Fuck me? Fuck you! There is not much difference. Just scratch a little. And you will find sinners in the saints, and you will find saints in the sinners. All good, all bad are just arbitrary, man-made. It's beautiful space you are entering if good and bad have ceased to exist. So far, so good. Now enter another dimension, not man-made, where distinctions are of no relevance, where nothing is good and nothing is bad, where whatsoever is, and whatever ends. There is no question of good and bad. Either something is or something is not. Good and bad are nothing but alternatives to be chosen. Either choose this or choose that. They keep you in the division of either or. The moment you start seeing the hocus-pocusness of all good and bad, when you start seeing that they are socially manufactured things, of course utilitarian. And I am not saying that go into the marketplace and behave as if there is nothing good and nothing wrong. I am not saying walk in the middle of the road. Saying that what does it matter whether one walks to the right or to the left? When you are with people, remember, for them still good and bad exist. Be respectful to them and their dreams. It is not for you to disturb anybody's dream. Who are you? It is not for you to interfere. Be polite to people and their stupidities. Be polite to them and their games. But all the time remember, deep down, nothing is good, nothing is bad. Existence is simply there. There is nothing to choose. And remember, when there is nothing to choose, you will become undivided. When there is something to choose, it divides you too. Division is a double-edged sword. It divides the reality outside, it divides you inside. If you choose division, you choose a split, you choose schizophrenia. If you don't choose, if you know there is nothing good, nothing bad, you choose sanity. Not choosing anything is choosing sanity. Not choosing is to be sane. Because now there is no division outside, how you can be divided inside? The inside and the outside go together. You become indivisible. You become an individual. This is the process of individuation. Nothing is good, nothing is bad. When this dance in your consciousness, suddenly you are together. All fragments have disappeared into one unity. You are crystallized. You are centered. This is one of the greatest contributions of Eastern consciousness to the world. The Western religions still go on hanging around the idea of good and bad. That's why it is so difficult for the Christian to understand Upanishads, Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu. It is impossible for them to understand. With the Christian mind, they are always looking, where are the commandments? And there are none. The Upanishads never say what is good and what is wrong. They never say what to do and what not to do. They don't command. They are poetic assertions. They are poetries. They exult in existence. They are ecstatic, overflowing. They are just ecstatic ejaculations. Upanishads say God is, and you are that. Tattvamasi. Upanishads say God is and I am God. These are assertions out of ecstasy. They have no ethics, no morality, no reference even. The Christian mind, the Mohammedan mind, the Jewish mind, cannot understand why these books are thought to be religious. They may be good literature, but why they are thought to be religious? And if you ask the one who has reached to the same ecstasy as the Upanishadic seers, he will say, the Bible, the Talmud, the Quran, they are ethical, moral. What they have to do with religion? They are goods. because they make a society move smoothly. But they have nothing religious in them, or maybe only few statements here and there. The major part is ethical. The religion seems to be just so small that it can be neglected, ignored, and it has been ignored. To come to know that nothing is good, nothing is bad, is a turning point. It is a conversion. You start looking in, the outside reality loses meaning. The social reality is a fiction. A beautiful drama. You can participate in it, but then you don't take it seriously. It is just a role to be played, played as beautifully, as efficiently as possible, but don't take it seriously. It has nothing of the ultimate in it. The ultimate is the inner. The indivisible soul knows it. And to come to that soul, this is a good turning point. You say good and bad have ceased to exist. This is the right moment to take sannyas. This is what sannyas is all about. Now there is no need to wait. Now there is no need even to ask my permission. Sannyas is already happening. You enter into this Buddha field. Long you have waited. Too long, really. I have heard an old couple reached to the divorce court, really ancient, 95 years old, and for 75 years they have been married. The judge could not believe his eyes. He said, "So you are thinking to divorce now? After 75 years of a married life? Why now?" They looked at each other, and then the old man said, "Well, we waited till all the children are dead." People go on waiting and waiting and waiting. Now what a hope! There is no need to wait anymore. You are welcome. You are ready. Even people who are not ready, I welcome them. Because those who are not ready today may be ready tomorrow. Those who are not ready when they take sannyas may be ready after they have taken sannyas. And who am I to refuse you? If God accepts you, I am nobody to refuse you. That's why nobody is refused. No condition is made. Nobody is thought to be unworthy. If God thinks you worthy to be alive, that's enough proof that you are also worthy of becoming a sannyasi.
you say, I am neither proud nor ashamed, and yet I am both. That's the state of confusion. In everything you will find like that, neither this nor that, yet both. Whatever I have achieved seems lost in a fog. You are really blessed, resolved together with my failures. Many should feel jealous about you. To know that all has failed is the beginning of a new journey. To know that all that I have achieved is lost is the beginning of a new search for something that cannot be lost. When one is utterly disillusioned with the world and all its successes, only then one becomes spiritual. Like a smoke I feel, but through the smoke a tremendous sadness arises, like a sharp rock with a velvet covering. It is bound to be so. When life has been lived through illusions and one day one suddenly feels all has been meaningless, useless, I was chasing shadows, a great sadness arises. But Ronald, I can see your perceptiveness. Sadness is there, but with a velvet covering. Yes, sadness is there because of the past, and the velvet covering is with the possible. That only becomes possible now. Out of all this confusion is sadness. But because of this confusion and its utterness, deep down a new stirring is happening. You may not be yet aware of it, but something is stirred. A new joy is arising behind the curtain of sadness. A joy of a new search, of a new adventure, of a new life, of a new way to be. Bhagwan, I can't perceive the end of it, or is there no end? There is a beginning of the mind and there is an end of the mind. There is a beginning of the ego and there is an end of the ego. But there is no beginning to you and no end to you. And there is no beginning to the mystery of existence and no end to you. It is an ongoing process. Mysteries upon mysteries are waiting for you. Hence the thrill and the ecstasy. Feel ecstatic that there is no end to life. That when you have reached on one peak, suddenly another peak starts giving you challenges. A higher one. A more arduous climb. A more dangerous reach. And when you will have reached to the other peak, another peak, peaks upon peaks. It is an eternal Himalayas of life. Just think of a point where you arrive and now there is nothing else left. You will be utterly bored then. Boredom will be your only fate then. And life is not a boredom. It is a dance. Life is not a boredom. It is exaltation, exuberance. Many, many things are going to happen. And many, many things will always remain to happen. The mystery never ends. It cannot end. That's why it is called the mystery. It cannot be known ever. It will never become knowledge. That's why it is called the mystery. Something in it is eternally elusive. And that's the whole joy of life. The great splendor of life is that it keeps you eternally engaged, searching, exploring. Life is exploration. Life is adventure. You ask Bhagwan, I can't perceive the end of it, or is there no end? There is an end to you, but there is no end to the real you. Is it ecstasy carrying the weight of impurity? There is no impurity anywhere. All is pure. Impurity is just a shadow of the confusion that you are feeling right now. When the confusion and the confusing mind is dropped, the shadows will disappear on their own accord. Your innermost core has always been pure. Purity is intrinsic to you. It cannot be taken away. Your virginity is eternal. You cannot lose it. There is no way to lose it. You can only forget about it, or you can remember it. If you forget about it, you live in confusion. If you remember about it, all is clear. I will not say again certain, but just clear. All is transparent. That transparency is freedom. That transparency is wisdom. This transparency is your birthright. If you are not claiming it, nobody else is responsible except you. Claim it. It is yours. It is yours just for the asking. Sannyas is an effort to reclaim that which is yours and to drop that which is not yours. Sannyas is an effort to drop that you really don't have and to claim that which you had always with you. All along, ecstasy is our very nature. Not to be ecstatic is simply unnecessary. To be ecstatic is natural, is spontaneous. It needs no effort to be ecstatic. It needs great effort to be miserable. That's why you look so tired. Because misery is really hard work. To maintain it is really difficult, because you are doing something against nature. You are going upstream. That's what misery is. And what is bliss? Going with the river. So much so that the distinction between you and the river is simply lost. You are the river. How it can be difficult to go with the river? No swimming is needed. You simply float with the river, and the river takes you to the ocean. The river is already going to the ocean. Life is a river. Don't push it, and you will not be miserable. The art of not pushing the river of life is sannyas. Ronald, you are ready. This moment of confusion, this moment of chaos in your life can open a new door, can turn a new leaf. Don't wait anymore. Enough for today.